And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Attention, people of Earth. Do not resist us. All who oppose us shall be annihilated. We command the most powerful army of monsters in the universe. They are sure to defeat your Earth monsters. All those who are hearing this are now under the control of the Earth Destruction Directive.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Earth Destruction Directive. I am your host, as always, Mr. Luke Giaconetti. Would like to thank everyone for downloading and listening to the show today. Our previous episode, we took a look at the Chinese giant monster film Snow Monster. We're going to change tact a little bit here. We are jumping back off of the moving image, back to the static image, if you will. We're taking a look at the Marvel Comics miniseries Mystery of Ultra 7, the third Ultra miniseries as published by Marvel Comics. Very excited to cover this. But before we get to that, we do have some news. So let's jump right into it. The second trailer for Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire has dropped as we build up to the release of the next installment in the MonsterVerse series. Now, this trailer is much more in-depth, builds on the scenes from the first one, including that additional tribe of giant apes and a new monstrous threat for the titular monsters, who's mostly in shadow. I'm trying to avoid spoilers for this. I kind of know what he looks like. I'm not going to get into it because I, you know me, folks. I try to go in with as little information as possible. There evidently are spoilers and leaks all over the internet. Like I just said, I'm avoiding all that. I like to go in fresh. You may do as you please, right? That's the right that we have as, monster fans, right? So anyway, all that having been said, GXK set to be released March 29th here in the United States. If you're outside the U.S., you're going to have to check your local listings for that one, but very excited to get another MonsterVerse film. Very excited to go back to the theater for this one, trying to figure out exactly how I'm going to do that. Normally I'd go with my friends. I know some of my friends are going to be traveling around that time, so I got to see who's available. And you know what? My kids love Godzilla vs. Kong so much. Maybe I'll just take the whole family instead of going with my friends. Be a nice change of pace. So we will see on that, but stay tuned. We are in the short time run-up now to Godzilla X Kong. In other movie news, Shout Factory has released their limited edition Classic Tokusatsu Collection, which is a 4 Blu-ray set featuring new English language subtitle translations for the films Prince of Space, Invasion of the Neptune Men, Watari the Ninja Boy, Golden Ninja, Dragon Showdown, and Ninja Scope. Now, these range from 1959 to 1969, and I've only ever seen two of these, and that's Prince of Space and Invasion of the Neptune Men, and as one might expect, that was on Mystery Science Theater 3000. So this should be a treat to get these classic Showa movies. Now, there is some question as to exactly what's included here under the title Prince of Space. That name, Prince of Space, refers to the compilation movie which combined the two theatrical Planet Prince films, both of which were only around an hour. But Shout Factory's description suggests it's only the first of those Planet Prince films which is included. So I guess we'll find out on that one. The set is up for order right now on shoutfactory.com. Very eager to get a hold of this because, these films, again, I only know a few of them, and that's only in MISTI form. So I'm really curious to check these out, especially with the new translations. And finally, in toy news, Titanic Creations has announced her upcoming articulated monster releases, and there are some doozies. Up first will be the 1966 version of Korea's national monster, Yongari. Now, following that, we will get the notorious Pulgasari, the North Korean monster, which We're going to cover that film at some point. Let's just say that's an interesting little movie. Then later on, we will see an articulated version of their original monster, Titanicus, which is one that started it all, as well as a re-release of sorts of their very popular Gorgo figure. All very exciting stuff for toy fans. Titanic Creations does really good work there. Gorgo, by all intents and purposes, has been a very popular release for them. Very well received that I've seen figure. For more information, check out their site at titaniccreations.com. And, if you like monster toys, check them out. I mean, I have a few of their vinyls. They're very well done. I don't have the articulated Gorgo. Space has really become an issue for me as far as toys and stuff, but the stuff of theirs that I have is really cool, and all the stuff I've seen is really cool. I'm going to be tempted by Yongari. I'm not going to bury the lead on that one. Yongari is going to be because I don't have another Yongari. Where are you going to get a Yongari toy, right? So go check that out at titaniccreations.com. Anyway, that's all the news I have for right now. If you have anything that you think we should talk about here at Earth Destruction Directive, why don't you go ahead and send it in, earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com, and we'll talk about it here on the show, and I'll even give you a little bit of credit for it. All right. That's what I've got. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and get right into it with Mystery of Ultra 7 right here on Earth Destruction Directive.
My name is Grundy, born on a Monday. The following recording was taken from an NSA wiretap of a Back to the Bins taping. No names have been changed. Everyone is guilty.
Do I need mine, or am I good where I'm at?
Well, now you do. If I have mine, you have yours.
You might want to yours only if you do have it set to automatically, because you don't want it to automatically, because the thing never works right. Because what will happen is it'll be used to you at a particular time, and then if you go out of that, it scrambles to and it doesn't fast enough. So it's better to just set it up.
Oh, okay.
It really doesn't work well.
So I checked. Right. I checked my my pre-king. It definitely billed me for the hotel for all three of us.
Join Back to the Bins every week for goodness. Solomon Grundy hate voiceovers.
All right, we are back here on Earth Destruction Directive. Mystery of Ultra 7 number 1 was released on August 17th, 2022 from Marvel Comics. As I said earlier, this is the third such miniseries from Marvel covering the Ultra series, following on after the Rise of Ultraman and Trials of Ultraman. If you take a look in the archives, you can find episodes covering those as well. Our writers are Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom, who collaborated on those two previous Marvel Comics series, and in addition have also worked independently on titles ranging from Boom's Power Rangers books to indie books such as Radiant Black and Supermassive, to DC mainstream superhero books such as Deathstroke and Nightwing. Independently, and together, these guys have touched on a lot of different little corners in the American comic scene. Our artist, primarily for the lead stories anyway, now there's a couple of backups, and we'll talk about the artists for those as we go, but our main artist is David Tinto. Now, this is an artist with whom I was not familiar, but from doing some digging, they appear to be best known for their Image series Commanders in Crisis, as well as doing some work on the long-running UK anthology 2000 AD. Normally, when I see a creator associated with 2000 AD, my ears perk up because, in general, I've liked what I've read of 2000 AD. Our colorist is Espen Grundejern, who returns after doing the colors for those two previous Marvel Ultra series. Espen's colored a wide variety of books, varying from Transformers to Soul Calibur to Street Fighter, and even Marvel books such as The Unstoppable Wasp. Our letterer is Ariana Mayer from Virtual Calligraphy, the ubiquitous VC. When you see an American comic, most of the times it says, VCs such and such. That's what they mean by that. Ariana has over 500 credits to her name, including, once again, the two previous Marvel Ultra miniseries. Our editor is Tom Brevoort, whom I mentioned because it seems like he's been at Marvel forever at this point. I didn't look this up, but how long has Tom Brevoort been on the editorial staff at Marvel? He's like the longest served current Marvel staffer that I can identify at this point. It's not, I mean, we're not in the bullpen days, right, when you knew the entire editorial staff. But Tom's been there for a long time, so shout out to Tom Brevoort. The main cover to issue one is by E.J. Sue. It depicts the titular Ultra 7 tangling with the monster Ella King. A good choice, considering Ella King is among Seven's most popular foes. It's a well-done poster image-style cover. Does a good job of putting our new hero front and center. I like it. Sue's got a nice, sturdy style that that they use. All right, so with all those details, we are going to jump into our synopsis, and it goes something like this. Our story begins on the planet Denbara years ago. A Denbarian trains her countrymen to battle kaiju without relying on the Ultra, but the training is not going well. Concerned that they are not improving fast enough, the Denbarian voices concerns to the Ultra that they are being manipulated to behave in a manner which makes more kaiju. The Ultra thinks that she is right, having seen similar patterns leading to destruction of worlds before. Unfortunately, the Ultra is forbidden to act on mere suspicions, but promises not to forsake the planet. We shift then to the Land of Light, where the Ultra, Delegate Seven, confers with his superior. Despite the overwhelming suspicions, without proof, Seven cannot interfere in the Denbarian's plight, only observe. Though his superior feels for Seven's position, he cannot advise him otherwise. Back in the present, at the Tokyo HQ of the United Science Patrol, we find Cadet Shin Hayata regaining consciousness in the infirmary after the long-thought-dead Dan Moriboshi absorbed Hayata's connection to his Ultra partner. You might remember this from the very end of the last miniseries, Trials of Ultraman. In his unconsciousness, Hayata has been having vivid dreams of a new Ultra, the flashbacks of Seven, which we, the reader, have seen. Specialist Ide surmises that these dreams were memories shared with Hayata when the Ultra energy was siphoned from him by Dan. Director Ichino Tani asks Hayata if he can transform. When the cadet says he cannot, the director replies that they have no way of dealing with the other Ultra, who is currently battling the kaiju Ella King. Flashing back to Denbara, Hayata has a dream/memory of Seven going into business for himself, discovering a link between Denbara and Earth, as well as the mysterious behavior of Executive Director Morheim in the past. More on that later. Seven's superior warns that his actions will bring about punishment, but at the same time wishes his charge a safe return. Back in the present, Hayata awakens again to be confronted by Morheim, who asks if Hayata has learned anything useful regarding what Dan is up to. Hayata blacks out once again and has a vision of Dan's ship crashing into Seven's intergalactic travel sphere and tells Morheim that Dan is not up to anything, since Dan Moriboshi is dead. Not much action, but a good start to the titular mystery, even though we still do not know why Dan stole the energy from Hayata, or if it even really was Dan. But, you know, that's why they call it a mystery. You know, one neat Easter egg is that Seven's superior is Father of Ultra, although he is not named. The flashbacks, they're intriguing. Hayata's in the same place we are as readers, and that both him and us are lacking the context of the scenes that we're seeing, and they're trying to put together their meaning as they play out. So I did like that aspect. Now, my favorite scenes in this issue are the early flashbacks. First, on Denbara, when Seven is talking to the Denbarian, he tells her straight up that even though his own protocols forbid him from taking action, he will not stand by and let them die. It's a small scene, but one that very succinctly portrays the love which the Ultras possess for the other races in the universe. This flashback also illustrates the idea that these races cannot be dependent on the Ultra to solve their problems. I like seeing this here, as we just talked about this same theme in episode 124, when we watched Ultraman episode 37, The Little Hero. Great to see these themes get picked up by Higgins and Groom here. The other sequence I really enjoyed was Seven and Father of Ultra in the Land of Light. Again, Higgins and Groom touch strongly on the theme of love for your fellow life forms, but that this love must be tempered with prudence, lest they become as gods. Father tells Seven, we cannot let our love for them become a justification for controlling their destiny. Insightful stuff for a property best known for giants battling monsters. The art here is a little more cartoony than I remember the previous minis being, but it's not out of place, nor is it hard to follow. All the characters look true to model, and the new ones, in this case, Seven, Father of Ultra, even the Denbarians and Ella King, are easily identified and rendered well. Overall, I thought this made for a strong first installment of the main story, and it made me very eager to grab the next issue. But like I said, we have some backups to address before we get to issue 2, so let's move on to them. Our first backup is From Rise to Fall, Part 2. Our writers are once again Higgins and Groom. Our artist is David Lopez, best known for his work at Marvel on All New Wolverine and Captain Marvel. And our colorist is KJ Diaz, who I know from Marvel's 2023 Wasp miniseries, which I rather enjoyed. Now, you might be wondering about the title. This is the second part of the previous Ultra Q backup, which was in the last series, hence the part 2. And our synopsis goes like this. On Sado Island in Japan in 1972, USP agent Ichino Tani and director Kato are investigating kaiju activity. After dispatching a human-sized monster, the pair come across the gigantic being known as Bolton. Bolton warps reality and creates another kaiju to attack the USP team. When the K-ray proves ineffective against Bolton, Kato leaps into close range with a laser blade. Returning wounded, Kato tells Ichino Tani that Bolton needs to be led off-planet and that it kills Ultraman. As Kato collapses, Ichino Tani wonders, what's an Ultraman? In the hospital, the recuperating Kato is visited by Executive Director Morheim. Morheim tells Kato that USP followed her advice, blasting all kaiju samples into orbit to lure Bolton away. Morheim then asks Kato what she knows about the Ultras. Kato responds that she knows enough to know why Morheim fears them, since she has been to the future. Morheim responds violently, grabbing Kato by the throat and demanding to know if the Ultras succeed. Kato says that Morheim will die burning and screaming, and that her masters did not spare her a second thought. Morheim strangles Kato to death before exiting the hospital room to tell awaiting Ichino Tani that Director Kato succumbed to her injuries. A short little backup here, only a few pages, picking up the thread of that previous Ultra Q backup story. Now, the teases with Bolton are intriguing, but I do wonder if they will lead anywhere, and we'll talk about that later. Morheim strangling Kato to death was a turn I did not entirely see coming. Very violent for, again, human violence is uncommon in this series. Mostly it's just been monster violence, right? Lopez's artwork on Morheim's face as she does the deed is the best image in this strip by far. She looks like a psychopath. All things considered, the backup is fine. I can't really dislike any story with Bolton. That's just me. So, hey, glad it's here and glad they're still fleshing out the history. Our other two backups are installments in the Kaiju Steps strip. Our writers are Higgins and Groom. The artist is Guri Hiru, who did the Kaiju Steps strips in the other two issue number ones of these Marvel Ultra miniseries. Now, we get two strips this issue, as I said. In the first strip, Pigmon tells us that civilians should not try to fight Kaiju. Good advice, but it ends up with Cadet Pierre stuck in a limbo dimension with the Dada. Whoops. The second strip, Pigmon advises us that we should not ask Ultraman for his autograph, as he is quite busy. He then cheers up Cadet Pierre by asking for his autograph. I like these little strips and honestly wish that they were in all the issues. I hope we get to see more of them in the future. I love taking the Kaiju Step version of Pigmon and repurposing him. You know, instead of making him like the other Kaiju Step characters are all preschool aimed, this is taking it and doing it in a cartoony PSA sort of way. So I really do like the Kaiju Step strips, and I'm glad that we get them more here. All right, with all the backups out of the way, it's time to go on to our second issue. So Mystery of Ultra 7 was released on September 21st, 2022, and had the same creative team as the first. The cover by EJ Su has Ultra 7 in a crouched fighting pose, with debris from off-screen Kaiju Elaking and Ghirardoras being tossed at him. It's a suitably weird cover with some nice perspective involving Ultra 7's foot looking very large in the foreground. It's also of note that Su draws 7's skin bunching up like a tokusatsu costume around the hips, which I found amusing, because there's always a question of, is their skin supposed to bunch up like that, or are we just supposed to, you know, gloss over it in our mind? So I thought that was nice. And our story goes like this. At USP HQ, Hayata is ordered under strict observation by Morheim after Ide informs the executive director that no technology exists to simply read Hayata's mind to determine what the Ultras know. Reflecting that he is a prisoner, Fuji reminds Hayata that they did go rogue once before. Hayata then lies to director Ichino Tani, saying he has seen no more of the Ultra's memories. We immediately cut to said memories. In flashback, Hayata sees Seven placed a fatally wounded Dan Moriboshi under his protection from Eliking. Seven explains that he and Dan are now linked, and that they are trapped in Kaiju limbo with no means of leaving. Dan says the USP will investigate and find a way, but Seven shows Dan the images of Morheim shooting a blast from her eyes, as we saw in the previous miniseries, and says not to trust the USP. Later, Fuji comes to see Hayata, who passes her a note saying that they need to get out of the USP and trust no one, especially Morheim. Back in the memories, Kaiju Limbo is being shaped by Dan and Seven's personal memories, looking like a mix of their homeworlds. When attacked by the Kaiju Dinosaur Tank, oh yeah, Dinosaur Tank, Seven and Dan work together to vanquish him. Dan is pleased at their teamwork, but Seven is concerned that the appearance of a new Kaiju here in Limbo suggests that more will be coming, and with no way to pass on, they will continue to clash and grow stronger, eventually pushing Limbo beyond its capacity. Back at USPHQ, Fuji gives Hayata a pair of night vision goggles. They make an escape under the cover of a blackout, but run into Morheim, whose eyes flash inhumanly. Fuji is able to disorient Morheim with a flashbang grenade, and they make it to the hangar where they are met by Ide. The trio escape in a jet VTOL as Hayata blacks out once more. In Seven's memories, he is facing the monsters Gomura and Skydon, but falls to Gomura's super-oscillating horn attack. The Ultra is reborn in a flash of light, since in Limbo neither he, nor Dan, nor the Kaiju can truly die. Said Dan and Seven restate their desire to work together to escape. Back in the present, as Seven battles Eliking and Ghidorah, Hayata, Fuji, and Ide fly over in the jet VTOL. Hayata says they must do something. Fuji asks if he has a plan, and Hayata responds that it's not so much a plan as a leap of faith, and he jumps out of the VTOL. We spend a lot of time in the flashback memories this time out, much more time than in the present. But given that the name of the series is Mystery of Ultra 7, that seems appropriate. And we get Seven laying out the nature of Kaiju Limbo and his suspicions regarding Morheim to Dan in a very word balloon heavy two-page spread, and from there more of Seven and Dan's challenges in Limbo. And given the nature of Dan and Ultra 7 on the actual show, this sort of interaction is new territory here, more akin to what we would see with different iterations of the Ultra series. The level of conversation between the two specifically reminds me of Haruki and Zet more than anything else, albeit neither character has the same level of naivete as those two. But here is where the decompressed quote-unquote modern comic scene rears its head. Yes, the scenes of Dan and Seven in Limbo are neat. I cannot argue with Dinosaur Tank or Gomura. Skydon, eh, but those two, no arguments. But they do not progress in any meaningful way in the course of this issue. Dan even restates his initial dedication to Seven and to getting out of Limbo, which was established several pages earlier. So while we do get some movement on what is ostensibly the A-plot, which is to say Hayata and Fuji going rogue from the USP again, the secondary plot mostly just marks time. The arc continues to be very strong here, especially in the action sequences. The battle with Gomura and Skydon has very strong visual storytelling from Tinto, as the monsters tag team our hero and ultimately defeat him. Tinto's cartoony style does pop up here as well, notably in the USP scenes and especially in his depiction of Fuji, who is very hippie in several of the shots here. His facial expression work is also strong. I know some people really don't like cartoony facial expressions in their Western comics. I, for one, usually appreciate them, so that doesn't bother me, but your mileage, of course, could vary on that. Now, overall, issue 2 continues the developments in the first issue, has some good action sequences, but the level of padding makes it feel more like half an issue than a full one. Still, the cliffhanger alone has me wanting to read the next chapter, so let's jump right to it. Mystery of Ultra 7 number 3 was released on October 26, 2022, and once again has the same creative team. The cover by EJ Su shows Ultraman and Ultra 7 facing off, with Ultraman turning away from the reader while 7 charges at us, with billowing clouds roiling in the sky above them. I like this cover as it evokes to me like contemporary 1960s Japanese pop art, like you would see in a magazine or toy advertisement. I could see this as part of like a package for an Ultraman and Ultra 7 figure set or something. So our synopsis goes like this, picking up immediately where we left off. Hayata falls to the earth, passing right in front of Ultra 7, and crashing into the ground at the giant's foot. This act forced siphons from Ultra Energy from Seven and into Hayata, similar to what Dan had done to Hayata previously, and Ultraman rises once more. Seven immediately attacks Ultraman, confusing both Hayata and Ultraman. Ultraman suggests that they try to use their new connection to sense his brother's feelings. Hayata senses that Seven cannot differentiate the past and the present, so engrossing are the memories of violence and trauma he is experiencing. Ultraman warns Hayata that if Seven is unable to fight with them, then they will have much work to do. We shift to Kato Tower, where we were introduced to Katsuchiro Kato in the previous series. Kato is on the phone with the mayor of Tokyo, who claims that the classified, quote, provisions in place for the city cannot apply to Chiba Prefecture, where the battle is taking place. Kato criticizes the USP for their policy of relying on the Ultras, asking, how does that look to be working out right now? The battle is still raging, with the connection between Ultraman and Ultra Seven seemingly allowing Ultraman and Hayata to stay transformed beyond their typical 3-minute limit. Seven defeats both Ghidorah and Eliking, while Fuji and Ide are forced to flee when additional USP Jet VTOLs arrive and order them to stand down. Ultra Seven attacks Ultraman again, and Hayata and Ultraman argue. Ultraman does not want to fight his brother, but Hayata says if they do nothing, people will be killed. Ultraman admits that Hayata is right, and to protect the people of Earth, he must stop Ultra Seven. Back at Kato Tower, Kato leaves his office to find his adoptive children at the ready. Given the grave situation, Kato says this is the moment for which they have trained. The order is given. Launch! Monster Attack Team! This issue is primarily the battle mixed with some dialogue between Hayata and Ultraman. To this point, we get not one, but two-page spreads. The first comes early on as Ultraman appears, and then the second is at the end of the story as Ultraman strikes Ultra Seven. Both of these two-page spreads are extremely nicely rendered, and both are suitably epic scenes worthy of such a depiction. But they also speak to the story at this point, as these eat up 4 pages of 20 story pages in the issue, 20%. Again, we are in the decompressed portion of the series, and I feel like part of this issue could have been collapsed with the previous and moved this 5 issues down to 4. That's just my take, however. I could be wrong. Anyway, the details about Seven and Dan being extremely negatively impacted by the recurring trauma they faced while in Kaiju Limbo, it's believable and appropriate for a series published in 2022 into 2023. It's not too much of a stretch to think that if you have been fighting and dying over and over and over for what is an indeterminate amount of time, that would not do nice things to your psyche. The payoff on the Monster Attack Team being introduced in the previous series finally comes, with Kato ordering his team to launch. Now, we will have to wait until next time to see what exactly that entails, however. The art is the star this time out, with many great shots of our heroes battling against various Ultra Kaiju as well as each other. Some standout scenes include Ultraman lunging to catch the passengers of an aircraft taken up by Eliking. On the background, Ultra Seven presses Ghidorah above his head like a gorilla press slam. Another shows Seven pinning Ultraman to the edge of a harbor with a right arm choke, while he reaches back with his left to slug his brother in the face. Tinto earns his keep this time out. Now, like I said, the action's picking up, so let's roll right into the next issue. Mystery of Ultra Seven number 4 was released on November 16th, 2022, and again, same creative team as the previous issues. Cover by EJ Sue depicts Ultraman and Ultra Seven looking at the mostly off-screen Jack, who we can only see his right arm, with the copy, "Who or What is Jack?" I'm a sucker for the "Who or What is?" copy on the cover of a comic book. And similar to the last issue, the artistic style reminds me of a Showa-style artwork. So it's not as suitable as a poster of the previous issue, but very well done, and I do like this cover. And our story goes like this. At Kato Tower, the MAT launches the MAT vehicle, piloted by all 4 members of the team. Back in Chiba, Ultraman is trying to stop Ultra Seven without hurting him, but in their tussle, they damage a dam. Just then, the MAT arrives on the scene. Rather than attack, Kato orders the MAT to secure the dam. The MAT vehicle separates into 4 units, which secure the dam as well as rescuing a damaged jetliner while the Ultras continue their battle. Seven begins to tire from his endless fighting, and Kato orders his team to stop the threat of the 2 Ultras. The MAT vehicles reunite, but in a different configuration, the MAT Mecha Jack. Ultraman tries to keep the 2 separated, but ends up punched by Jack and shoulder thrown by Seven for his troubles. Jack spools up an energy attack for 7, but Ultraman intercepts it, using the last of his energy and reverting to Hayata. Jack engages 7 directly, knocking him prone and preparing to deliver the final blow. Back at Kato Tower, Kato is contacted by Morheim, who taunts Kato's playing at Heroes as pathetic. Kato asks Morheim if 7 is her new alien, to which she responds that of course he is. Further, Morheim tells Kato that she is pleased that she will be responsible for killing his children as well as his mother. Shocked, Kato is stunned that Morheim admits to the killing, to which she flippantly asks who would believe him if he told anyone. Enraged, Kato gives the order to the MAT, kill the alien. Building directly from the last time, this issue is even more of an action and battle intense, as nearly all the page counts taken up either with MAT doing their Thunderbird slash Go-Go 5 routine, or the battle between the three giants. The elephant in the room for me is changing Jack from an actual Ultra, as seen in the series Return of Ultraman, to a transforming mecha. Personally, I'm of two minds on this change. On the one hand, it does not make much sense for Kato to have an Ultra on his roster, not given the nature of the introductions of both Ultraman and Ultra 7 in the Marvel series. The use of advanced technology is not only in line with what we've seen for the USP as well as Kato's group, but in the Kyodai Hero genre, and even in a broader tokusatsu context, battling monsters with super technology is a familiar and welcome generic element. Now, on the other hand, though, part of this all seems incredibly cliche. On a regular basis, I would estimate at least several times a year, I get either asked if, or outright told that, Ultraman is a giant robot. I think for Western viewers, the idea of a giant robo is such a traditional Japanese concept that the assumption is simply that any giant character fighting monsters is a robot. Power Rangers, of course, plays a big role in this, but even before that, import anime like Gigantor, Voltron, or the Force 5 helped establish this long-standing pop culture language of the giant robo from Japan here in the United States. Even the Powerpuff Girls, a favorite of mine from my college days, had the girls pilot a giant mecha named Powerpuff Dynamo, who was clearly inspired by Ultraman. Silver skin, solid yellow eyes, and a blade on its head, not entirely unlike Seven's Eye Slugger. And of course, Ultraman has fought beside mecha before. This was a major theme in Ultraman Zet. So bottom line, I can't have too much of a beef with this choice, as it does allow for another hero to join the fray. Now, as to why Jack is silver and red, and the exact size of both Ultraman and Ultra 7, I think I'll just leave those elements aside for the time being, okay? Morheim admitting to killing Kato's mother, as we saw in the backup, is in issue 1, it's intriguing. She seems to be playing a long game, the end goal of which is not seen in this miniseries. Spoiler alert. Hopefully we will get more of this story. I'll talk about that more after issue 5. Once again, the art is superb here. The depiction of Jack as a mecha is well done and looks realistically like it could have been produced from the 4 individual vehicles. Of note is that the merged MAT vehicle resembles the MAT Arrow 2 from Return of Ultraman, but the individual vehicles are original designs, not referenced to any of the other MAT vehicles. The sequence where MAT saves the dam and the jetliner is my favorite scene in this issue. As I mentioned above, it has a strong Thunderbirds vibe, which is not a complaint. I am a sucker for the rescue team motif and was glad it was used here. And as we are up to the final issue, let's not dawdle, let's get right into it. Mystery of Ultra 7 number 5 was released on January 4th, 2023, and once again has the same creative team. The cover by EJ Sue depicts Ultraman and Ultra 7 double-teaming Ella King, punching the Ultra Kaiju in the face, causing his head to snap back towards the reader. I like the layout of the cover, but the details in Ella King's mouth look weird. I can't put my finger on it. There's something off-putting about that big yellow grill of Ella King on the face with no eyes when it's upside down. Cool cover, makes me do a double take. Anyway, our story goes like this. Jack has 7 dead to rights, but the Ultra leg sweeps the mecha, and the battle is back on. Hayata contacts Fuji, who along with Ide are at Kato Tower to try to resolve this without bloodshed. Kato thinks the USP agents are there to capture him, but Fuji explains they are not with USP anymore, and that Director Morheim fears the new alien. Fuji adds that she doesn't think the new alien has any ill will towards humanity, and that he does not deserve to die. Kato orders MAT to disengage, which they do. This opens Hayata a chance to drain all of 7's energy. Doing so, he finds himself in Seven's Ultra Zone, where Seven states that he must protect Dan at all costs. Hayato reaches out, saying that he understands the trauma and the pain, and that he and Seven can be brothers as well. Through this act of compassion, Seven transforms back into Dan Moriboshi. Hayata, Dan, Fuji, Ide, Kato, and the MAT all assemble at MAT's beta site hidden inside of a mountain. While the teams compare notes, Dan awakens and apologizes to Hayata. Rather than explain what happened, Dan shares his memories directly with Hayata. In Kaiju Limbo, Seven explains to Dan that he is fading away, as his ultra physiology needs the energy of the stars to survive. Seven describes it as a sort of hibernation, saying that he and Dan are bonded, and that if Dan can escape Limbo, he may be able to rise again. Disappearing in a flash of light, Dan is left on his own in a world of rampaging kaiju. Dan dies over and over again, thousands of times, only to be reborn each time thanks to the nature of the kaiju Limbo. Dan finally sees Ultraman and Fuji flying through Limbo, as we saw in the first miniseries, but they do not hear his call for help. Finally, as Ultraman tears apart the walls of Limbo, when he destroyed the kaiju vault, Dan finds himself back on Earth, as we saw at the end of that first miniseries. Dan tells Hayata that he did not intend to steal all of his ultra energy, but once he started, what was left of Seven's personality took over, and that Seven was clearly not ready to be restored. Dan beats himself up over his shame, but Hayata forgives him and introduces him to the rest of the assembled team. The USP Rebels and MAT confer and agree that the USP, and specifically Morheim, is now their enemy. Kato discusses a strange energy to which Morheim has access, which he stole during his time at USP to power the MAT mecha. Hayata speculates that this is the same energy which allowed Professor Nikaido's artificial kaiju from the previous miniseries to operate. Dan adds that whatever angle Morheim is playing is tied to the kaiju cascades which have destroyed whole planets. He then adds that he will not be much help in the coming crisis, to which Hayata gives him a small amount of ultra energy so that when Seven is ready, he can rejoin the fight. Hayata then says that whatever the USP is up to, they were not ready to face the combined forces of Ultraman, Ultra Seven, and Jack, and that they will continue to protect this planet and any others from Morheim's conspiracy. The Ultra Guard is formed today. Back at the Land of Light, a familiar Ultra, one might say an ace, talks with Father of Ultra, showing him a report that the growing darkness on Earth is getting worse. Father says that this is a crucial turning point for the planet and perhaps the galaxy. Ace says, but we're unable to intervene, right? But Father Ultra merely says, The action quotient drops right off in this issue, as instead the resolution of the conflict is peaceful. Appropriate for a battle between Ultras, I would say. Thematically, the desire to defuse a situation without hurting anyone unless there is no other choice is one of the cornerstones of the Ultra franchise. We see it back in Issue 3 when Ultraman says he will not fight his brother, and I like the symmetry here of seeing Hayata take the same path. The character moments shine in this issue. Dan's sorrow and shame, Seven's devotion to protect Dan even as he is seemingly at death's door, Hayata's loyalty and forgiveness, all of these ring true both for the characters as we know them here in the Marvel continuity, as well as in the larger sense of the Ultra series. And what Ultra fan would not like to see the various heroes, both human and Ultra, team up? A couple of other nice fan touches. At the MAT beta site, we hear Ide explain that you can just name and invent whatever you want. You don't have to justify it, which greatly amused me. That is so Ide. The other moment is when Dan is apologizing to Hayata. He says that his Ultra is named Delegate 7, to which Hayata assigns to himself terrible name. I'm going with Ultra 7, which is about the best way I can think to bring that name in given the context. My main criticism of this issue is the same criticism I have of the series overall, so let me just roll right into it. This really is just a middle chapter, moving the pieces around and setting up what ostensibly will be the big fight at the end. We needed to introduce Ultra 7, reveal the mystery of how Dan survived. We had to pay off the teases of the MAT and Morheim being an alien, and really, we only get one of those fully here. So this miniseries struck me as less intriguing and less involved than the two previous series. The decompressed nature of the middle issues also does not help. It might be a common criticism from me, but this could have been done in two issues or perhaps even a giant-sized one-shot rather than a five-issue mini. Four at the most. There is just not enough story here to justify the page count. Now, please don't misunderstand. That is not to say that nothing happens in this series. Quite a lot happens. And there's a lot of space devoted to the characters and addressing the themes of trauma and abandonment, which form the crux of Dan's character arc. Given the greater understanding and awareness in our society about individual mental health and the results of trauma, I did appreciate Higgins and Groom not being afraid to dig into what being in a situation like this would do to someone. But at the same time, when you have two issues which are mostly just combat, the final product ends up feeling a little padded. I like the reveal of the mystery. I like the setup for the future. I just wish this one did not lean so hard on that middle chapter vibe. Now, one area which I must give ample praise is the artwork. David Tinto put his own unique stamp on the characters whom we have seen for 10 issues prior to this, as well as characters like Ultraman, Ultra 7, and the Kaiju, to whom we have other visual reference. The cartoony style as human figures gives the work an energy and differentiates it from the earlier books at the same time. And when called upon to create something new, mainly I'm referring to the mecha version of Jack, he's successful. I'm not an art-first kind of guy when it comes to comics, but I gotta say, this is a good-looking series. Now, as always, we must look to the future. Towards the future? That'd be the correct way to say it on Ultra Show. Anyway, will we see this continue? Now, the last issue of this series came out more than a year ago as I record this episode, and we've not heard anything about a new series. The physical copy of issue number 5 includes a house ad featuring Ultraman, Ultra 7, and Ultraman Taro, who has not featured in these series at all, looming behind a cityscape where we see the Marvel characters Iron Man, Captain Marvel, the Carol Danvers Captain Marvel, and Spider-Man battling the monster Bemular. Now, this was announced in August of 2023, as a Ultraman versus the Avengers or Ultraman Avengers crossover. But that date's come and gone without the book dropping. We've heard of other Ultra licensing products coming soon, including that new Netflix anime, but nothing from Marvel Comics. I sincerely hope that this crossover, as well as a conclusion to the ongoing story, if that was not part of the crossover, is still in the works. But unfortunately, with comics these days, you never can tell. Overall, I did enjoy this series, but I must admit that I like the previous ones a little bit more. In the grand scheme of things, if we get the conclusion, this will go down as a transitional chapter that is filled with strong character moments, powerful battle scenes, and great artwork. But as it stands right now, it's a little frustrating because of the decompressed storytelling in the middle chapters. If you were expecting to see Ultra 7 kicking kaiju butt and taking names, it's not necessarily the series for you. But if you dug the last two Marvel Ultra minis, then by all means, check this one out. Now, if you would like to read Mystery of Ultra 7, you can get the collected edition on all the usual sources for physical and digital comics today, these days. Amazon and Comixology, kind of the two big ones. Now, if you have the Hoopla app, which I heartily recommend, I think everybody should have a library card, and if their library supports Hoopla or Libby or I think the other one's Canopy, I think. I haven't tried Canopy. But get a local library card, see what digital service they provide. But on the Hoopla app, you can check out the miniseries there for free, as well as the other two Marvel series if you need to get caught up. All right, so now I throw it to you, the listener. What did you think? Did you read Mystery of Ultra 7? Did you like this one? Do you think the pacing was okay? Did you think the pacing was a little slow? How do you think it compares to the last two? What do you think is going to happen in the future? Are you excited to see the conclusion? Or are you like, yeah, no, just as good? So whatever your thoughts, I'd love to talk about them here in the show. Email me, earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. You can also, of course, reach us on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. I'd love to hear from the listeners. I would love to hear what everyone thinks. All right, that's all I've got on Mystery of Ultra 7. I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with a little bit of listener feedback and closing out the show here on Earth Destruction Directive.
Kenny, I'm starting a podcast. Recruit me and co-host with attitude.
What the heck? I thought we put that teleporter in storage. Michael? Next time you want me on Kaiju Weekly, tell Jimmy to...
Drop the act, Nathan. This is not the Monster Island Film Vault.
Okay, fine. But what's going on?
I'm having you join me on The Power Trip, a journey through the Power Rangers franchise. It's a podcast version of the article series I'm writing for Kaiju Ramen Magazine.
Oh, interesting.
We'll spend a year analyzing the Power Rangers franchise, dedicating an episode to each season and movie.
Ah, I see. So we'll be doing an overview and talking about them in broad strokes.
Exactly. We'll discuss Ranger teams, the villains, the theme songs, and so much more.
Can we we give out fun awards for stuff like the best fight scene and the craziest moments like I do on Henshin Men?
You bet.
More phenomenal. When do we start?
We drop episodes every 2 weeks starting Tuesday, January 4th, 2022.
You know what that means, Michael.
It's Morphin time.
All right, we are back here on Earth Destruction Directive. And I hold in my hand a little bit of listener feedback. If you would like to get in touch with the show, you can email us at earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. You can also reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter or the YouTube or on our Discord server. And we'd just love to hear from you. So let's get into our email, which comes from listener Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. Robert writes on the subject EDD 123 Oblivion Time. Hi, Luke. Hi, Robert. I always enjoy your episodes. It gives me a chance to learn something about an area I know little about. As far as the IDW miniseries Godzilla Oblivion, I enjoyed your synopsis. I listened while out on an evening walk. It started bothering me how quickly all the backup plans were able to come together. Just happened to have the metal and could quickly make an army of Mechagodzillas, and then had the plan to get the body of King Ghidorah, and make it Mecha King Ghidorah. I was so glad you addressed that. I did enjoy and could picture in my head the nuclear blast over the ocean with Godzilla and King Ghidorah in silhouette. I need to go find that picture when I am done writing this. Well, yeah, that was a major thing. It was the how quickly things seemed to just unfold in that series, right? It does seem admittedly, in a series about interdimensional portals and giant monsters, that was what was pushing credibility for me. So what does that tell you, right? Robert, I'll see if I can scan that image from my physical issues of Godzilla Oblivion, and I'll put it up on social media so everybody can see it, about Godzilla and King Ghidorah with the silhouette on the nuclear blast, if you haven't had a chance to find it. Robert continues, maybe I missed something, but why couldn't they just open the portals again and send all the monsters back to the other Earth? While I appreciated that they were going to try and get as many people off their Earth, it makes more sense to me to have the nanites make portals around the monsters. Yeah, that could have been a solution. I mean, that's kind of nihilistic, isn't it? Just sending them back, but it's like, at the same time, it's like, their world was already destroyed, right? You know, we didn't ask them to come over here. See, these are questions that weren't asked in the series, Robert, so I'm glad you're asking them, because, you know, the series didn't bring them up. Robert continues, also, when sending all the people to the other Earth, wouldn't that cause issues there with so many more people, food, clothing, shelter? Okay, I know I'm going too much into the weeds in a book about giant monsters, but I just had to ask. No, these are legitimate questions. That Earth was a wasteland. We saw it in the first issue. That Earth was, it was destroyed by monsters for years and years. So how are you going to, you know, suddenly clothe and house and feed billions of people? This again, not answered, not even asked. So again, we're thinking on the same wavelength here, Robert. Absolutely. So. Don't ever worry about overthinking a comic. That's like the American comic book fan stock and trade, right? Overthinking comics. Like, what is that? The book is called Understanding Comics. Maybe my book should be called Overthinking Comics, right? I think we'd get some traction on that. Look for the Kickstarter next year. I'm kidding. There's no Kickstarter. We're not. Oh, no. No. Anyway, Robert closes out. Thank you again for the episodes. Keep them stabbing. Robert Ludwig, Nevada, Iowa. Robert, thank you very much for writing in. Glad you appreciated the episode and glad you had similar questions about some of the logical problems with Godzilla Oblivion. You know, these IDW comics, they published just so many of them that they are kind of all over the map a little bit when it comes to the story. So they're always fun to visit here on the show because it's been a while since I've read any of the older minis. So sometimes I remember them. A great example, Half Century War. I remember James Stokoe's Half Century War fairly vividly. There's a lot of great stuff in that. Like Oblivion, I remembered the basic story, but not the details. So it was great to revisit it. It was almost like reading it again for the first time sort of situation. So thank you very much for writing in, Robert. Again, if anyone would like to write an email to the show, earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. Social media feedback, thumbs up, likes, reshares, reblogs, reposts, all that good stuff. For the last episode came from my brother, Jason Giaconetti, John Vanover, Derek WC from the Fanholes podcast, Mr. Lomax, the aforementioned Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Chris Mounts, Gene, the podcasting machine, Hendrix from Two True Freaks, Brian Sever, Billy D from the Magazines and Monsters podcast, John M. Wilson, Professor Allen from the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Entertain this. Nathan Marchand and Jimmy from NASA, together they are the Monster Island Film Vault. Crystal Lady Jessica, the Power Trip Podcast, which just wrapped up, I believe. So hats off to the Power Trip Podcast. Great job, guys. Finishing something you start is always commendable. Good job. And also the Henshin Men Podcast, Two True Freaks themselves, and Bro Rad. Thank you very much for all that social media love. I say it every single time. A podcast like this is a labor of love. We do it because we enjoy doing it, and seeing that feedback not only helps boost the profile of the show, again, whether it's Earth Destruction Directive or any other podcast you listen to, that like, that share, that repost, whatever, if that helps the show get out there to just one more listener, it is appreciated. And just showing that appreciation, that you appreciate the show enough and like the show enough and dig the content enough to take the time to do something with it on social media, is very much appreciated and always welcome. Thank you very much for all of that. Also at this time, like to say that Earth Destruction Directive is for everyone. If you are interested in giant monsters, you can be a part of this show to the level that you feel comfortable. If you want to just lark, if you want to comment, if you want to send me email, any of that stuff. We're not a gatekeeping show. We're a show for the people. You know, everybody starts somewhere when it comes to giant monsters. Don't feel like that. Oh, I don't want to go, you know, and listen to those nerds or whatever. They're going to think I'm fake or whatever. It doesn't matter. Everybody starts somewhere, right? And maybe you're excited about, you know, Godzilla X Kong, right? And you're getting caught up on the Monsterverse. Maybe you saw Godzilla Minus One because somebody took you to see Minus One and you had your mind blown in the theater. And now you're dipping your toe into the wider world of Daikaiju. You're welcome here. Everybody's welcome. All are welcome on Earth Destruction Directive. All right. Next time, what are we covering next time? So we're going to be changing tact a little bit. We did a movie and then we did a comic book. Well, now we're doing a video game. So very specifically, we're going to be talking about the Godzilla the Series Monster Wars video game for the Game Boy Color. You might recall a number of years ago, we did Godzilla the Series, which was a black Game Boy cartridge, and those can be played on either Game Boy Color or the old school Game Boy. Well, this is a Game Boy Color exclusive sequel called Godzilla the Series Monster Wars. Picked this up a couple of years back. Very eager to dig into this. I know the Monster Wars story on the Godzilla the Series show is very well regarded. Eager to play this game. I figured we did an episode with Gino last year for his 25th anniversary. It's only appropriate that we give Zilla Jr. a shout out here the year after, right? So in addition, I'm going to bet we're probably going to have at least one episode talking about Godzilla X Kong, just given the time of when this episode is dropping. So keep your eyes and ears, I guess, open for that on the feed, hoping to get something up for that. I always try to do something when we get a big major Daikaiju release like this. So I'm going to do the same here. So other than that, that's all I've got. Thank you everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed us talking about Mystery of Ultra 7. Hope you will come back next time for Godzilla the Series Monster Wars on the Game Boy Color. And I hope everybody gets an opportunity to go see Godzilla X Kong. I hope everybody enjoys Godzilla X Kong. I just hope everybody has a good time. I mean, that's me, right? I'm the guy. I got told once I like everything. It's like, well, maybe I only talk about the things I like. You ever think about that? Yeah, you know, it's a novel concept here on the internet. Anyway, I'm rambling. So thank you everyone for downloading and listening. Please come back next time for Godzilla the Series Monster Wars. And until then, keep them stomping.
This has been Earth Destruction Directive, a Daikaiju podcast, produced and created by me, Luke Giaconetti, as part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, available at twotruefreaks.com. This is a fan work celebrating the history and culture of Japanese giant monsters. All movies, TV shows, comic books, characters, and other intellectual property is copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended or implied. If you would like to send an email to the show, you can email me at earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. I try to respond to all emails, and if you send in some comments, I will read them on the show. All episodes of Earth Destruction Directive can be found at twotruefreaks.com. You can also find the show on your favorite podcatcher. Just search for Earth Destruction Directive. You can even leave a review on your podcatcher of choice if you'd like. You can find me on Facebook, Just search for first name Luke, last name EDD. You can also get in touch with me on Twitter. Just search for the handle at LJacone. That's LJACONE. The theme song for this podcast is Future Gladiator by Kevin MacLeod, downloaded from incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 license. Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next time for more city-stomping fun here on Earth Destruction Directive. Tune in next time to hear the crusty old podcaster from Oklahoma say,
"There's a WTF moment if I ever saw one."